We talk about Heat culture once again, putting fear in the hearts of Boston, Brandon Ingram's future in New Orleans in doubt, and we dig into the Knicks' connection with Villanova. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. Joining me, not as always, but again, as it's fit to be, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports, it is my man, it is your man, it is everyone's man, it is the one, the only, the legend, the legend himself, it's Dan Devine. What's up, buddy?
Not much, Jake. I missed you. It's been a couple weeks. I had to tank last week for writing purposes. Like Ben Rohrbach and I were doing a ton of series preview stuff. So between that and then also a sick kid at the beginning of the week, multiple like critter infestations here in the apartment, which we haven't talked about, and I don't want to get into on microphone in a big way, and just not generally like not sleeping a lot. It was a long week. So I didn't just bail out to like, you know, leave the NC Armada hanging, I promise. But it has been a long time and I shouldn't have left you without a dope beat to step to. So here I am back. Fred Katz, thank you so much for stepping in, but get out of here, Fred. You know, the ruler's back.
And shout out to Tom Haberstroh for filling in for myself when I was unavailable several weeks ago. So we're back now. It's been a while. I've got some rain damage, interior, exterior, battling with the condo association / the insurance company. And Liberty Mutual was an advertiser in one of the games last night. And my girlfriend and I proceeded to boo them as they showed up on TV. So yeah, I won't get into that any further as well. But if this is some type of public admonishment that will in turn help me, I will not be disappointed by that. But we'll get into not that later and other things and more. But first, let's talk about last night's games, because that is why you are here. That is why we are watching the ball right now. The playoffs are here. This is our first playoff edition with Dan and myself in the chair. I'm excited. I'm jazzed up, largely because Heat culture did it again. They did it again. I texted some friends who are Heat fans. I want to read it last night. I just wrote culture in lower caps as the game was closing. This is a married couple. The wife goes in all caps, "Fucking let's go, write about it, let the people know, fucking Boston, walking out." So that's all you need to know.
That's true. You got to give that. Like, the Heat fan base took so much crap for so long about like, and still does, like late arriving, early leaving, whatever. It was the diehard leather-lunged Celtics fans that were hitting the exits with a minute left last night, getting, you know, stern talking to's from Stan Van Gundy, right? Being like, why are you leaving 47 seconds early? How far are you getting home? Also, we just watched what happened with the Knicks. What's going on?
If anyone's been to TD Garden, which I have been plenty as a former Boston College student who earned my stripes with a Slam Magazine credential around my neck in that hallowed hallway, that underneath the stadium, much like Penn Station and Madison Square Garden here, but even worse, I would say, in Boston, all the commuter rail lines and everything, it is you can't get out of there anyway. What are you rushing out the door for? You're going to be rushing to be stuck in a Dunkin' Donuts line that's intersecting with a regional rail line, that's intersecting with the orange line, that's intersecting with the green line. Like, come on, guys. Disappointed there, but it's fine. It's early. And I would say more of my energy was definitely devoted to my maybe doppelganger, maybe just favorite rookie, Jaime Jaquez. I thought it was an awesome moment for Tyler Hero in particular. But Dan, I want to let you isolate in the wing of the 2-3 zone and shoo off the closeout and the hedges and the doubles and do whatever you would like to do in your analysis about last night's game that tied the series 1-1 before things shift back down to South Beach. And we'll see how interesting things get from there.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that blew or sort of stuck out to me right off the bat was, like, I watched the Heat play almost the exact same game last year. It was Jimmy Butler hurts his ankle game one against the Knicks. you know, we were there watching it. And the second game of that series, it's, we don't have Jimmy, we have Bam and shooters, and we're just going to like change the way we play. And a ton of, I think they got up like 49 threes or 50 threes in that game. And they were a possession away from winning it against the Knicks. The Knicks like escaped with a win in that series and in that game. And I'm like, this is what they do where like, if you can't play the way you know, your sort of standard preferred way of playing and you are up against the wall, Eric Spoelstra is going to say, how do we jack up the variance? How do we give ourselves the best chance of winning? And it's like, bomb threes, muck it up, go from our, like, we've been, Heat have been dropping more a ton in their pick and roll coverage this year. Forget it. We're switching. And we are going to play like as straight up as we can on Boston stars and say, we're going to make, either you're going to score or you're going like, to, but we're not going to give up the other, like the open shots, the Celtics machine all season long, drive, kick, open three, swing, swing, open corner three. We're not giving that up. And if you can win that possession battle, we get up way more threes than you do. You don't get the in rhythm open looks for your guys. We can drag this game into the mud. And that's where, I mean, Miami won this game while making five shots in the restricted area. They won the math battle. And it's not just that. I know Ben Rohrbach was there last night to write off the game, and the Heat are adamant, like, it's not just about that. It's not, and that's true. Like, they were on a string defensively, super locked in as far as like not giving up easy opportunities that could get your Drew Holidays or Derek White's or Kristaps Porzingis, the other guys in rhythm. And it really opened up the door for them. Like, you're not going to get run out of the gym early. You make a few shots early. 16 of their first 20 field goal attempts for the Heat came from beyond the arc. And it's like, we are going to try to chop one of your legs out early, or at least keep ourselves close enough that we can make this tight. And we feel like if we make it tight on you, you're going to start to tug at your collar and not feel as comfortable, because you remember all the times in the last 3 years that we've done this to you. And I don't, it's a little bit too armchair psychologist to say that the Celtics started to feel that, but they certainly played like a team that didn't have like the utmost confidence or the utmost comfort in what it was doing. And, you know, they go back to Miami without home court advantage. The Celtics were the best team in the NBA from the opening tip, 64-18, number one in offense, yada, yada, yada. And they find themselves back staring at the Heat and saying, we got to now win three out of the next five games against these guys when we don't have home court advantage. It's really, really wild.
And one record statistic, whatever, that you didn't, I mean, it's a record that you didn't state, was 37-4 at home, the best home regular season team in the entire NBA. And they drop one right off the bat. Obviously, they had the big 30-point win in game one. But what a response. And I think the two guys I really want to shout out from the Miami's, and Caleb Martin just does everything he can to beat Miami. It is unbelievable.
Turns into Michael Jordan when he sees green.
His splits against Boston and other teams I saw last night, I don't remember exactly off top of dome, but it was like roughly 14 points per game compared to career average of against all of their opponents of 7 points per game. So he's truly doubling his production on average. And the Heat now have four playoff games. This is, I saw from Cooper Moorhead, that got retweeted and quote tweeted all over my timeline last night. They now have four playoff games in the past two seasons shooting above 50% from three against Boston. No other team has more than one against anyone. So incredible. There's something about that green and red. Like you said, maybe it's the Christmas energy. I don't know. Maybe it's Pat Riley still doing some heebie-jeebie juju, whatever, from the New York days. But I want to give a shout out to Jaime Jaquez, for real, being that we had to fill out a roundtable stuff for this morning at Yahoo Sports. One of the first prompts was, who have you been most impressed by, player, team, whatever? And I said I first wrote back to our editor, Matt Wong, I wanted to wait until the games got going last night to really start to think about it. And just from the very early goings, one of the biggest adjustments I saw from what Miami did was, instead of, because I was there on last Wednesday in Philly, right? Jimmy was obviously playing on that bum knee as things were going down in the fourth quarter, but kind of just like shifting off ball. And pretty much every play was a high pick and roll for Tyler Herro and Bam Adebayo. And Miami was so creative and inventive in getting him off ball adjacent to all the actions that ended up putting him in pick and roll situations, whether that was on the side with Bam or whatever. And a lot of that started with Jaime Jaquez doing point guard things.
Yeah.
And it just got, it just made me flash back to, I remember that Philly playing game. He was driving in and throwing a shoulder at Joel Embiid and not giving a shit about it and finishing over him. He was locking down Tatum one-on-one in the paint in crunch time last night. And it got me thinking how, shout out to Caitlin Cooper. She has obviously made the Tyrese Halliburton jump passes are cool again thing real. In a similar vein, you were not supposed to pick up your dribble, particularly in traffic. But I kind of get this sense from just watching the last couple of postseason environment games. We've now seen four for Jaime Jaquez at this level, both playing games, both games in Boston. He somehow feels more dangerous when he picks up his dribble, and that's when he gets to get that pivot foot going, baby. And it's, I mean, it's been remarkable all year long, but in this, at this stage, I've been so impressed about at that stage of his possessions when he loses the live dribble, his pivot and his head fakes and all that. He was doing it in the regular season in ways to score, especially when they get switches and matchups that he likes to take in the post, which is a whole nother thing for rookies to do.
Sure.
But to do it in a way that's also making plays and spraying out passes to all five guys around you against Boston on the road in the playoffs was a sight to behold, man.
Yeah, Jaime Butler, right? Like, that's the thing. It's like the same style. And, you know, Heat writers have been on it all season. Like, he can do a lot of those same mid-post things. I mean, obviously not at the level of, like, multi-time All-NBA superstar.
Are we sure? Are we sure? He's just a rookie. Maybe he will. Maybe it's true, is just a first.
No reason to put anybody in a box, right? No ceiling on his game. But you're absolutely right. Like, the patience and poise in those moments to not get frustrated, not get flustered, not get sped up, and have the presence of mind to find your reads, find your outlets in those moments, or give a defender an opportunity to make a mistake and give you an opening, you know, to get to the rim. You know, and have that huge three. I want to say like three and a half minutes left, 4 minutes left, something like that.
Yeah, I'm on the right wing.
Yeah, as they were trying to, you know, keep the Celtics at bay and put the game away, and just for Miami to now have another one of those guys like Caleb Martin. Obviously, we've mentioned his splits, but someone that you feel you can trust on defense and you trust to take shots, and is empowered and confident to take the shots on offense when they swing to him. Haywood Highsmith has been a developmental story, and now is somebody that, yeah, they feel good, like 6'7" wing. They feel good putting him on opposing star wings. He will take the shot, well, you know, make or miss it, but he's willing to take it. And that attitude, the mentality, Nikola Jovic has been coming along there. He was starting mm-hmm. the last chunk of the season.
Ball handler, Nikola Jovic.
I was going to say, yeah, he was doing some of that bring the ball up initiation stuff too. I think he finished with 6 assists last night. Like,
yeah.
And when you have multiple guys that can initiate and multiple guys who can, you know, grab the rebound and bring it up, you're absolutely right. That gives Hero the opportunity to not just have to attack or initiate against a loaded up defense, but to come off an off-ball screen, come off a curl, be on the move already. And that seems to be when his decision-making, when he's sort of the most engaged and able to manipulate a defense at his best. 14 assists last night. Eric Spoelstra said after the game in a video that the Heat had tweeted, sent around, like, that was the best decision-making, playmaking game you've ever had here, which, you know, that's a pretty big statement.
That
given
one pass to Bam where he froze and fired it down to the baseline from the top of the key was probably the best play I've seen him make.
Yeah. And the threat of his shot, I think he made 6 threes, but the threat of his shot off the dribble, the threat of his shot coming off the catch forces the closeout, forces the additional attention. And then to be able to not get bored making the right decision and say, like, spray, kick, give somebody else the opportunity. I'll get mine later. Like, that's growth. That is a young guy who he has been adamant, and, you know, certainly has never lacked for confidence, but the guys that he came up in that same sort of cohort where it's like he's coming after Booker out of Kentucky or Trae Young or, you know, Luka or SGA or whoever, he's looking at all these guys and being like, I belong in that conversation. And everyone's sort of like, yeah. And one game does not put you, in that all NBA tier, right? But you saw what value a three-level scorer with that kind of decision-making and playmaking touch can have against what has been one of the very best defenses in the NBA all season, and he just took it apart. And he had a lot of help. Bam, in the two-man game, was like every time they needed an outlet, getting to that free throw line jumper. But he, but also the pocket pass has to be there. The service has to be on time for Bam in those situations. And, you know, Miami scored, I think it was just under 1.3 points per possession when those two guys were on the floor together against the Celtics. Like, that is elite, elite stuff. And because of that, because of the way that they defended in the second half, the way that they made shut off the water to all those other guys and said, all right, Tatum and Brown, you bring them home or you make the right decision again. Make those guys make decisions and make them feel like, or let them have the opportunity to take a jumper instead of get to the rim, right? And you put those, you sort of get them in between their ears a little bit and things can get a little staticky. So whether that persists, like, I don't know that this means that Miami's going to be able to do this three more times, but I think a lot of people didn't think they were going to be able to do it once. So, you know, they've put themselves in position to have a real shot to win this series.
Yes, they have. The last thing I'll say to the Jovic thing, yeah, I went down, when I went down to Miami late March, for I was following Denver play Toronto. They flew down to Miami. I followed them there for a story that we're saving for later in the playoffs. And someone on Denver, we were just like watching Jovic take threes. And he says to me, you know, he's been starting for, he's not going to start for them in the playoffs, right? And here he is. It's just the latest iteration of Miami figuring out, mixing and matching different first round picks and undrafted guys and unheralded dudes and sending them down to Sioux Falls and bringing them back. It's something that I don't think to transition from what we have in our notes to the next game and series here. I don't think Boston should necessarily be afraid of going down to Miami, but there are certainly a lot of demons in the closet down there. And the big criticism and skepticism about the Celtics team around the league heading into this time of the year, it stems on this. It's like, just because you're the number one seed and have all these gargantuan numbers and whatnot, the other team is going to make you take it from them still. You don't just walk in and get spotted the spread that Vegas assesses to your odds here. And that might be the one team that you really didn't want to have to do that against. So
one thing before we go into the next game, just as far as the numbers on this, it's worth shouting out. The Celtics, 22 for 49 from three-point range in game one, 12 for 32 in game two. And to me, the 32 is the bigger number. The Celtics had only taken fewer than 33 threes four times all season. That is their recipe. They want to be the one jacking up the variance. They want to be the one getting more bites at the apple from three-point range. You had Kristaps Porzingis and Jrue Holiday. I think you got to be a little bit nervous if you're a Celtics fan. This is what we had talked about. Like, Jrue Holiday's shooting percentages have gone off a cliff in the playoffs. Kristaps Porzingis has not played in a playoff game since he was in Dallas and barely had any impact there. Like, this is seeing the damn it time game from them already has to give you a little bit of pause there. And then the Tatum and Brown, right? First game of the season of the series, they took 30 of Boston's 82 field goal attempts, about 37%. Last night, 43 of 80. And they only had, so that's 53%, and they only had four assists. So if you get the assist rate down, you get those guys say, we're going to let you trade twos for our threes, and you're not going to get anybody else off. That's, you know, this is where a team that was a juggernaut and was rolling and didn't seem to matter who, what the coverage was, who the defenders were, you know, this is how they, that you can sort of, it can hit a speed bump and, you know, maybe slow them down enough to where you can get them a couple times here.
The Thunder went off in Oklahoma City last night.
Yes,
124 to 92 victory over the Zion-less New Orleans Pelicans. After, to me, game one, you have to give credit to Shea overcoming some questionable decision-making and missed shots, probably from like the 5 to 2 minute mark of that game, and then just actually did everything that he's been doing for the last couple of years in the final 2 minutes. But that game felt to me a little bit more still like New Orleans fumbled the bag at the end of game one, then Oklahoma City came and took it. And you flip the script to game two, where the Thunder just came and sunned New Orleans from start to finish. And I want to highlight Chet Holmgren for the start, being that, look, personally, I will admit it. I will come forth to the church in front of all the NCR Armada and say that I was not a Chet Holmgren believer. I had this image burned in my brain. I watched two college basketball games of Chet Holmgren at Gonzaga. One was against Paolo Banchero, where Paolo was clearly the best player on the floor in that Vegas Invitational, whatever the tournament was. The second was when Tyler Johnson, his younger brother, I think it was Landon Johnson, I apologize for not having his name correct, was at St. Mary in the Western West Coast Conference Championship game. This like 24-year-old guard, fifth-year senior, whatever he was, just drove through Chet's chest at the rim and finished over him with ease. And I was like, man, if this dude is able to do that, I don't care how long he is, I don't care how good he is at blocking shots with both hands, any NBA guard with any type of muscle mass is just going to be able to knock this guy around, and he's going to be zero threat at all. And I was happy for the dude all regular season, but I wanted to see it in the playoffs. And the way he's dropping dudes with his shoulder, the way Jonas Valanciunas, who might be the biggest guy in the entire NBA in terms of just like volume, is
density, mass,
including the beard. And also a shout out, as the lady Fred has been watching some of these games with me now that they're on more often in the big screen and not just me like watching it in my room on some Monday nights. She was like, is that Travis Kelce? Which I thought was hilarious.
Yes.
But for Chet to hold his own against him and the shot being, I mean, every time he catches it on the wing, it's like, oh, you have to stretch that defense so far in order to even attempt to try to close out. And you're not blocking it anyway. So shout out to Chet. I want to give a shout out to Kaysen Wallace for the end game stop on game one, but bringing it back to game two. Yeah, just from the jump, the starters came out and looked like they had been there 17 times before, and not being the youngest team in the entire NBA with 108 combined points, 18 assists. The ball is just zipping and they're dribbling and kicking it out, and the shooters are knocking it down. It's as simple as that. And with that crowd, it's a really fun place to watch a basketball game take place in. I have not been there since December of 22, but there's a lot of stuff happening down in Oklahoma City right now.
Yeah, Chet finishes with 26 points on 13 shots, 7 rebounds, and 2 blocks. This is from Justin Kubatko at Statitudes. First rookie in NBA history to make multiple threes and block multiple shots in consecutive playoff games. Only the 7th player ever to open a postseason with 2 of those games in a row. So you're like, this is again, you know, lights not too bright, physicality not too much. The game translates. And I think what we're seeing, what's sort of stuck with me from Oklahoma City last night, it's like they maybe just realized after game one, yeah, maybe some jitters, maybe some adjustment period for, you know, for everybody. You sort of survive that, you get past that, you move forward. And then maybe they realize, like, wait a second, without Zion being here, there's like no one on this team we have to worry about sending help on. Like, we don't have to, we can just say, like, Lu Dort, go deal with Brandon Ingram. And you can get up under him. He is not going to shake you. And if there's nobody that's going to force you to put 2 on the ball, like no help that has to come, no rotations that have to happen, then you've got Trey Murphy and Herb Jones and CJ McCollum and whoever else fanned out on the perimeter, but like no one, you have defenders on them. There's no open. So it's, can Brandon Ingram shake himself loose for a mid-range jumper? If Brandon Ingram goes 5 for 10 from the field, like, and 3 assists, and he's not generating open good looks for anyone else, your offense is going to die on the vine. And that's what we saw. You know, the Pelicans in the competitive portion of this game, the only real source of offense that was consistent for them that we saw was at the very beginning of the game, Valanciunas lowering his shoulder into Chet, playing through him. I think their first 11 points. It was the very brief period of the game where they held a lead. Once Chet started answering back with pick and pop threes or face up drives, and it became clear. Oh, and then Willie Green responded by being like, well, we can't keep Jonas out there to get torched. Let's go to Larry Nance. There's really just not a lot of pathways to points for New Orleans in this matchup. If Ingram is not going to play like an all-star, play like I will create an advantage that forces a rotation that allows me to spray to somebody else. And he is capable of that. Like, his decision-making can be really good. He can be a high-level playmaker. But against this Thunder defense with the individual defenders, largely Dort, but also Jalen Williams, You know, the guys they can throw at you on the wing, there's just not a, a lot of like perimeter creation. And then if you're like looking for, okay, where, who is, comes in off the bench for us to make plays, it's Jose Alvarado, right? But then if you're playing Alvarado and CJ McCollum in the backcourt, you're way too small to deal with. And it's just Shea saying, you screen over there. Like, he's like scrolling through his options of who do I want to hunt in the pick and roll. And yeah. Jalen Williams can do that too. There's just so many pathways to easy looks for them that are not available to New Orleans without Zion. So barring Ingram leveling up in a major way back at home, or Zion's hamstring starting to feel a hell of a lot better sooner than anticipated, I'm not sure New Orleans has enough pathways to points against this Thunder defense.
Yeah, you harped on two personnel things for New Orleans' roster that are definitely starting to fully go under the microscope in this environment, particularly with Zion out. It's that center trade-off between JV and Larry, and the fact that New Orleans has never, of course, really maximized, optimized, whatever word you want to use, this Zion BI pairing. And with Zion out of the picture, it is kind of even somehow more showing Ingram's limitations. And look, I know fans will say the big bad media is always the responsible party for spinning things forward to the offseason and looking at doomsday things. But I'm telling you, this is just how decision makers look at these things. Whether it's New York getting a massive sample size here about what this team looks like without Julius Randle.
Sure.
Whether it's pick any number of situations, the Lakers trying to figure out, LeBron trying to figure out how to exist in any existence outside of this series beyond this season. Like, this is the ultimate litmus test for what your build is. And New Orleans was one team, I believe we saw this on the show, that like kind of really didn't have any plan to make any tweaks at the deadline because they just wanted to sit back and see how it all unfolded. And the two things that they have had in mind have been the switchy, athletic, rim-protecting center that they clearly don't have, and was on that dearth was clearly on full display last night. And that like real table setter guard that is kind of like the Kyle Lowry to Kawhi in Toronto, or like what Drew was to Giannis in Milwaukee at points, even like a Chris Middleton. Like, I think Vinny and Tom on Wednesday's Good Word were kind of comparing what BI is to Zion to what Middleton has been to Giannis, in a way that I think kind of makes some sense just on stylistically and where they get their shots from. And people on the league are talking about it, man, that like the future of Brandon Ingram is something to just monitor and be prepared for a conversation growing about that if this series continues to hold, especially with Trey Murphy did not have the game to follow up that he probably would have liked after all the praise got heaped onto him after game one. But like, he's coming and extension eligible. Herb Jones did New Orleans a massive favor by taking the 4-year, $52 million deal extension that he took. But like, he needs more playing time as well. If Trey Murphy is going to be coming into the fold and taking more minutes, you probably don't want him being taken from your other burgeoning two-way wing. So it's just something, these are the things and the through lines that talent evaluators around the league are watching these games. Just because the regular season's over doesn't mean pro scouts from other teams aren't still going to these games and watching and evaluating and taking back their information and reporting it back to their front office. I think if I'm looking at anything around the league, Brandon Ingram's long-term success and ability to perform in New Orleans is probably at the top of the list right now, I'd say, and what people I've spoken with are just considering as this series moves forward.
Yeah, just one quick note on that. That's an important one. Chris Middleton over the last 3 years has averaged 7 3-point attempts per 36 minutes. Ingram is at 4. And so that's like the one in terms of where they get their shot, where they get their shots from and how much they open up for their rim marauding big guys. Like, that's that's why if you're a Pelicans fan of a certain, you know, who views things through a certain lens, you look at it and say, remove him and put Trey Murphy in that spot and say, take 11 threes per 36 minutes and just and take them from 30 feet away.
Trey Murphy will do that.
He will gladly oblige, but like, but also put you far away, force the rotations, force the help, give Zion all that room. And Zion also, that's another note I saw when I was sort of researching about this. Zion was ninth in the NBA this season in assists that led to threes at 220 of them. The next closest on the Pelicans was Ingram, who had like 70 fewer in 100 fewer minutes. And so like he just doesn't, it's not the way his game operates, generally speaking. And obviously, so that's it plays a massive role in this matchup and in this, you know, where are you creating advantages? But moving forward, yeah, like to look at it and say, if Ingram is not going to take more threes, which it does not seem like his comfort level, it does not seem like whether, you know, whether he's been coached to do it or interested in it or whatever, that like, he's a good enough shooter to be able to do it. He just doesn't, that doesn't seem to be the game that he wants to play. Then it creates some more spacing concerns for an offense that's already got them. I don't know. So I'm maybe Valanciunas pilled from way back. I kind of believe that I think they could win with him. I don't think they, I mean, obviously if you had Chet, great, sure. But there's the years long conversation about like, what if you can get a Miles Turner type or Miles Turner to be that guy next to Zion? I get it.
Yeah.
But I think like Valanciunas is closer to a solution than a problem in this series, I think, especially just given the lack of other options. It's more to me about the guard play and the perimeter play on the Pelicans not being able to open up, you know, crowbar open enough scoring chances. And if they can't do that consistently enough, OKC is going to get better shots more consistently. And then they got better tough shot makers in Shea and Jalen Williams. And it's a tough recipe to deal with when you're an opposing defense.
And I really like Brandon Ingram. Like I went to Providence, Rhode Island for
shouts out
for Duke's. Yeah. Alumni.
That's
for
right.
For Duke's 2015 NCAA tournament, where it just so happened that Yale beat Baylor and I was there for the Torian Prince rebound. We talked about that. And like that his parents, they will not remember that. Talked to Jerry Stackhouse. This was his AAU coach. And like, always liked the guy, soft-spoken dude. I was so fascinated by the Brandon Ingram versus Ben Simmons debate and the start of their career. So they got compared to each other and blah, blah, blah. And I was on Team Ingram at the time. And then like was really nice to spend some time with him in Manila this summer. But like he was kind of, his limitations were kind of put on just like the international stage. And like he couldn't really thrive when the ball wasn't in his hands on that team. He couldn't really thrive as like a floor spacer. His future is going to be really, really interesting. That's all. So let's put a pin in that and take a quick break to pay some bills. And we'll be back to talk about Brandon Ingram's former team, the Los Angeles Lakers. Welcome back to No Cap Room here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast, where Dan Devine is about to espouse wisdoms on how the Los Angeles Lakers can overcome a 2-0 deficit after losing 10 straight games to the reigning champion Denver Nuggets. Now, I think
might involve a time machine and some magic. I'm not sure. Or an alternate reality in which the Lakers are the ones that drafted Jokic in the second round.
Where someone goes to Serbia and sends Nikola Jokic in a... This was because Passover is on the brain, puts Nikola Jokic in a cradle and sends him down the river to somewhere far, far away and changes his destiny. Now, I think we talked about this with Fred last week, all the hobnobbery about the Lakers potentially trying to lose on purpose to avoid this matchup. Like, I understood why it was a thing, because this is obviously happening right now. But like, you don't duck the smoke, and you would have had to see this team at some point if you wanted to accomplish your ultimate goal of winning a title, and might as well vanquish those demons now. I know there's definitely a prevailing thought amongst decision makers, like, all right, we probably do want to see our toughest opponents later in the playoffs where there could be injury misfortune and whatever, even though we're not rooting for that. Like, that's just the brass tacks of things, blah, blah, blah. But like, I don't have too much to say other than this. When I left Passover Seder on Monday night, took the night off to celebrate around the table with 22 people of my girlfriend's extended family. And we get in the Uber home, and I saw it was like 9 minutes to go in game two, and the Nuggets were down 23. I said, oh, this would be fun to watch Denver come back from. Like, I didn't even have a different thought. It wasn't, oh, wow, the Lakers are up 23. It was, I'm going to strap in to watch this comeback effort. And to me, that just sums up what Denver is. It's not even really about the Lakers. There's plenty. I mean, we can talk about that. We can talk about what the Lakers aren't in comparison to what Denver is. Mm. But to me, it's kind of doesn't matter. Like, to me, we're just watching this perfectly cohesive five-man lineup have all the answers all the time. And they will lose a game in the playoffs. It will happen. Maybe they won't. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll go fo-fo-fo and I'll look like an idiot. But I don't think they're going to lose many, just like last year. And maybe my bosses will look at this as like couching and not putting the analysis into the microphone that they pay us for. But
they're not listening. Don't worry about it.
They're definitely listening. I don't think there's much more to say other than Denver's five-man lineup is sick and the Lakers have two stars and are getting zilch consistently from anybody else.
Yeah, that's huge. You know, John Gennaro, super producer, was kind enough to put some of the production numbers in our doc here. And like, yeah, like LeBron's averaging 26.7 rebounds and 10 assists plus 3 stocks a game in the series. AD is averaging 32 points a game. He's, you know, like playing 7 more minutes per game than he did last year. He's shooting the lights out. Like these guys are giving you just about whatever they can. It's just in the absence of consistent production elsewhere and in the absence of those superstars have to elevate your complementary pieces as well, it leaves you susceptible. But I mean, it's also like this is a recipe that is given the Lakers double digit leads over the Nuggets like multiple times in the course of their matchups. And it just like the Nuggets closing kick. I wrote about this after the trade deadline when the Nuggets kind of started to kick it into high gear. It's just different than everybody else's. They are a good shot, a quality possession machine late in games. And this is pretty sick, honestly, like a sickening thing. We're using the word sick as a fun adjective here. But the Nuggets have scored 39 points in 11 clutch minutes against the Lakers this season. They are 14 for 18 from the floor when the score is within 5 points in the final 5 minutes. They have 8 assists and 2 turnovers. It's basically 2 points per possession in crunch time, like a guaranteed bucket in crunch time against this Lakers team. And this is like, again, continuing a theme. They scored 129.5 points per 100 against the Lakers when they had Jokic, Murray, and Aaron Gordon on the floor during the regular season. They scored 125.3 points per 100 against the Lakers with those three guys on the floor last postseason. They've been significant, like major pluses against the Lakers with those guys on the floor, even in this series with Murray shooting 18 for 48 through the series. Like, and the level of confidence that the Nuggets have, they've seen it. There's no question about what they can generate and how they can generate it, the flow they can play with, and the things they can crack open against not just this Lakers defense, but any defense really, but specifically against this Lakers defense. This is the confidence that's born out of doing something 10 straight times. And I thought it was special and kind of interesting that with Jamal Murray really struggling, right? 3 for 16 through the first three quarters. Shouts out to Stone Cold Steve Austin. 3 for 16 through the first three quarters of that game. The Nuggets were just like, yeah, no, you're gonna keep going. Tony Jones at The Athletic had a great line in his story. Colin Gillespie went over to him in the third quarter to Jamal Murray and said, like, you're gonna hit the game winner. Like, we have that level of confidence in you. And Jokic feeds that confidence. And this is a shout out to Jared Dubin at his Substack last night in basketball. Quote, according to Second Spectrum, Jokic threw 21 passes in the fourth quarter. 17 of them went to Murray. So like Jokic is just saying, we believe in you. We know you are going to make these shots for us. I am going to not let you be the playmaker and say, like, I don't have it tonight. I'm getting off it. No, we are going to force feed you because you are going to make these shots. And then he did.
And so like the level of confidence they've got, the level of execution they reach, and the degree to which it's like it doesn't matter how much they're down, or it seems like it doesn't matter how much they're down, in part because they're going to make you, they're going to wear you out. And that's the other number I want to hit. Shouts out to Tom Haberstroh, not to take his big number, but Anthony Davis, we mentioned his scoring, right? The first halves of these two games, 42 points on 18 for 23 shooting. Second halves of these games, 22 points on 8 for 19 shooting with more turnovers than assists. The amount of the work that Anthony Davis has to do on Jokic and offensively, I think it grinds him down over the course of big minutes, especially when, as they did in game two, the Nuggets can throw Aaron Gordon on him as a defensive, like, so you're splitting the responsibility between Jokic and Gordon for dealing with AD, and he's got to deal with both of them.
And they're splitting the backup center minutes with those two guys as well.
Yeah. And so it requires a ton of AD. And especially, as you mentioned, if you're not getting complimentary offensive production from, you know, consistently from D'Angelo Russell, from Austin Reeves, from Rui Hachimura, who's had a real rough series so far, and so on, like all down the line.
Yeah, I thought Rui was the answer to stopping Jokic. What happened with that?
Yeah, that turns out that there aren't good answers, but that one certainly had it had staying power for, I think, like a half of basketball a year ago, and not so much since.
Yeah, in the interest of time, like to me, watching Denver and the fact that, and from being around that team, the fact that everyone in that locker room and organization knows starts with Jokic and Jamal, and everyone falls in line behind, that to me is a real thing.
Yeah.
And like we talk about how much importance culture is in these team building discussions and from an organizational standpoint. On the court, what I truly believe from all of my years of doing this matters is having that hierarchy and established pecking order is important among these guys. When you think about how everyone's comparing their money to each other and all the touches and the stats directly correlate to that. But when you even sift it into the context of winning and looking around the court and knowing who is going to do what and what time it is and which guy is going to rise to that occasion, that to me was something that I thought was encouraging about Orlando's regular season, where it really seemed like in their first year, I saw the potentials of the early Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown headbutting and people from the outside wondering if they could play together and will it work and blah, blah, blah for Franz and Paolo. And this season, and people around the Magic really talked about how the pieces were kind of falling into place where Paolo was your lead dog and Franz was willing and accepting being the number two. And everyone was kind of falling in line, which was the exact antithesis of what happened in Orlando's last rebuild from the Dwight Howard era that I talked about and wrote about in a book over my shoulder, where Channing Frye, I'll never forget, one of the best quotes I've ever heard, said that all the guys, the Victor Oladipos and the Elfrid Paytons and the Tobias Harrises and one Aaron Gordon, were like rats on a ladder climbing over each other because there was no real, this guy goes first and this guy's going. It doesn't have to go that way, right? Because Jimmy Butler's going to get hurt and Tyler Hero's going to step up and Jaime Jaquez is going to step up, whatever. That's a far-reaching, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
With Orlando having all that figured out, I thought they were going to come to Cleveland and be better, and they just haven't. The offense has gone completely awry. Paolo's part of the problem, unfortunately to say, after I gave him that spotlight and I got into a fierce debate with one of my most trusted intel men, basically saying like Paolo coming out and saying I'm the guy and everyone has to follow suit is like questionable to him. I asked the question and so like I didn't put those words in his mouth, but I like presented that query to him for him to pontificate. Like it wasn't just him beating his chest and saying I'm the guy, but like 2-to-1 turnover assist ratio is not what you want. And he's shooting below 30% from three, can't buy a free throw. Franz has fallen down. I mean, the defense has traveled. That's kind of been their thing all year long, but they're 18-23 on the road all regular season. And they do seem to get a massive lift for their home crowd. So if we're spinning this forward, maybe this is just like a scenery will change things and the role players, especially young role players, will the shots will fall more in front of familiar rims and a fan base that's rooting it forward. But the Magic are looking a lot, awful lot like the Cavs looked last year.
Yeah, I think as important as an established hierarchy is, having guys who can shoot jump shots is also really important when you get to the playoffs. Sure. Like, and as the guy who wrote our Mavs or Magic Cavs series preview and picked the Magic in six, I am feeling like I should have had my goddamn head examined for picking a team that cannot shoot to win in the playoffs. Yeah, I mean, you can't hierarchy and defend your way out of 17 for 72 from three. And, you know, a lot of the things that we're talking about, and I know we'll kind of rifle through them quick, like Paolo is part of the problem. Paolo is a young guy in his first playoff series with who is like experiencing the outsized defensive attention and some of the growing pains that happen for every young player. Like, he's a 6'10" guy who dribbles a lot and drives. Teams are going to dig in on him. His handle's not as tight as a small point guard. He's going to have a harder time dealing with guys that are sort of digging down or the extra help defender. He goes into his move. He's getting into his bag, the back down turnaround. They're sending a double from the blind side and he can't see it, right? Like, he has to learn all this stuff. And this is how you learn it. It's painful. Yeah. This is what,
I believe he will. I believe he will.
Yeah, he has. There's no reason he can't, but this is how that happens. And you mentioned Cleveland having that rude awakening, that learning experience last season. You know, whether they're benefiting from it or not, it certainly seems that Orlando is going through that same situation now. Franz Wagner, same deal. Like, eight for 23 inside the lane. Like, he's having a really tough time finishing over the top of Evan Mobley and Jared Allen. And, you know, if you just don't have a whole lot of, like, if Cole Anthony is going to go 0 for the series, then you got no shot, right? Like, you have to find other sources of offense. The hope is that comes with the regular rotation guys. If not, Jamal Mosley maybe needs to think a little bit harder about, like, shuffling the deck because you're not getting enough production from the backcourt. But, you know, is Caleb Houston going to be your answer? Is Anthony Black going to solve all your problems? I don't know. Maybe it helps somewhat. Who knows? But yeah, like, this is it is a young team going through the trial by fire in real time and getting burnt.
The Sixers are going through trial by Villanova right now. And I think it is so funny and so Philly that people would complain about the Villanova team account posting highlights of Knicks players who went to Villanova and won two championships at the goddamn school. I wrote a rather long feature yesterday at Yahoo Sports about all the tricks and trades that made that Nova program successful from 2016 to 2018 and produced 12 NBA players this season, if you include Ryan Arcidiacono, who played 20 games this season. He played 20 games this
Delightful
season.
Delightful information and stories from Ryan Arcidiacono in Jake Fisher's story.
He was awesome. He was awesome. And he officiated Jalen Brunson's wedding. Dante DiVincenzo was his groomsman. And like that family theme, when you go to Rick Brunson being on the coaching staff and Leon Rose being, if not legitimately, at least in spirit, Jalen Brunson's godfather, and all these guys coming together to do this in the NBA for doing what they did in college. To me, the most important thing from that story that I learned was that there is this kind of like lineage aspect through the Nova program, where you mentioned Colin Gillespie earlier, like, Ryan Arcidiacono challenged and taught and led Jalen Brunson, who did the same thing to Colin Gillespie behind him. And Josh Hart did that for Mikal Bridges, who did that for Dante DiVincenzo. And their practices in that 2018 title run, to a man, from the coaching staff to the players, were all saying the practices were way harder than the games.
Yeah.
Because Jay Wright was doing all these kind of like twisted sadistic things to like make best friends have to fight each other to the proverbial death over a loose ball.
Thankfully it's proverbial. Yeah.
100% proverbial. And mixing and matching lineups and like the first team going against the second team, if you did the exact thing you were supposed to do, he would say, nope, that's a turnover. And the other team's getting points. Just doing whatever you could to throw and juice adversity into that gym. It has turned into this and a 2-0 series lead, which could easily be an 0-2 hole. Could very easily be so. I don't want to get into all the officiating, complaining, and whatnot, because look, Daryl Morey is the lead executive of the Sixers, and Nick Nurse is the head coach. Two men who have pretty extensive postseason histories of publicly commenting on the officiating. Nick Nurse's record of that pretty much, if not exclusively, is predominantly composed of him complaining about the refereeing guarding Joel Embiid from past Toronto Sixers matchups, which is funny to have that now be flipped and have him fighting and arguing on his behalf. But to me, I just think if we're looking at this from a preview standpoint, it's going to be loud as hell in Wells Fargo Center. I am bringing earplugs tonight. After we record this, I'm going to hop down the Amtrak, head down there. I am bringing earplugs. And there's two things I'm curious about, aside from all the big stuff, like how healthy is Embiid? What's Maxey going to do to follow up that performance? Like, if we're looking at this similar to how the Lakers are down in their 0-2 hole, like, we kind of know what we're going to get from Embiid and Maxey. They have done pretty much everything you could ask those two dudes to do, especially considering Joel Embiid's health and the fact that he is nowhere near 100%. He's dragging that leg around like he's just carrying all of Philly's entire process year's burden attached, and it's extra weight and a ball and chain. And I have no criticisms for what he or Maxey has done at all. It's the ongoing, what the hell is Tobias Harris doing? Can Buddy Hield remember to shoot the ball? Can they inbound the ball and get a rebound? Those are the things that are just the little attention to detail, the Villanova way. That is not Villanova basketball. And that to me has been the difference so far. Those little cracks that the Knicks have filled by diving onto the ground and hitting the offensive glass with reckless abandon. That to me has been the difference so far.
Yeah. That when called upon, those complimentary guys for the Knicks have been able to come through in ways that Phillies have not. And, you know, in game one, it's Deuce McBride, Bojan Bogdanovic. Bojan only made two shots in game two, but they were huge at the beginning of the fourth quarter, both threes. You know, Isaiah Hartenstein and Mitchell Robinson sort of tag teaming on Embiid, and like Mitch had a great first game. Hartenstein had a great second game. I'm writing about this now, or not right now, cause I'm talking to you, but, sort of the reason that has needed to happen to that such a great degree for the Knicks is because Jalen Brunson has been sort of dramatically under his, standard. I think it was 16 for 55 from the floor in through two games. He has been the focal point of Philly's defense all over the court. You know, you talk about the Villanova way. Kyle Lowry has been putting himself in the Villanova way of Jalen Brunson every opportunity he gets by leaving Villanova buddy Josh Hart on the other side of the court and saying, if you're going to make threes, we'll lose. Well, Josh Hart's made 8 of 15 threes because they have lost, you know. So to what degree Tom Thibodeau and that Knicks offense can open things up for Jalen Brunson, get him, you know, sort of on track. That I think is a pretty big potential swing factor in game three and moving on. And then also like if the Sixers maintain the defense that they've played, which honestly they should, like the Knicks half court offense has not been good because of the way that the Sixers have junked up their coverages with sagging off of Hart, with overloading to Brunson, all that kind of stuff. It's been the offensive glass, it's been transition, and it's been a couple of super timely shots. Like, play the percentages. Josh Hart's probably not going to keep hitting those shots. Get back in transition better. Limit the offensive glass. Like, they did a better job of that in the first half of game two. As Embiid's legs started to hurt him more in the second half, the Knicks started getting to the glass more easily. Like, you just need a better effort there. But you're absolutely right. Those games were in the balance down the stretch for a reason. And I think you can reasonably argue the Sixers have had the two best players in the series. That translates and that holds in game three. You know, then the Sixers could put themselves in position to get even this thing up over the weekend.
One last thing, if you're listening to this as your game three preview for tonight in Philadelphia, DeAnthony Melton might return.
Yeah.
And for Philadelphia. And he is someone that definitely people in that Sixers building are hoping can be a real asset as a secondary piece, both shifting into some Jalen Brunson minutes on defense and also that off-ball shooting that is so important to stretch opponents, to get Joel openings to operate, and to give Tyrese driving lanes. So that's going to be another interesting thing to watch. We've got an interesting thing to watch right now before we get out of here, because when Tom Haverstraw filled in for me on No Cap Room a couple weeks back, he and Dan played a game where they tried to describe one Paolo Banchero's basketball game using nothing but player comps. I liked that game. And I also had just kind of come back from my rec league championship where your boy was crowned victorious. And then I officially retired from rec league. I'm here wearing my championship shirt.
I was going to say, you got to check us out on YouTube because you can see that Jake is wearing his championship shirt.
And I played about as well as one could have hoped in with the legacy on the line. So there was a live stream, and we have gone back and procured the footage to which super producer John Gennaro has cut into a little, I'm not going to call it highlight reel because they're not really high, but they're sizzling. A little sizzle reel. So this is admittedly aimed a bit more for our YouTube audience.
Yeah, you got to get to YouTube to watch, because then you'll be able to see what we're seeing.
But we could also whip this up and post it in some type of social video where it both makes fun of myself, but also people know I can shoot that thing. Because I will say, at the Passover Seder with 22 people, before I watched Denver's comeback that I expected to happen on my phone, there was a distant cousin, not even, it was my girlfriend's best friend's extended family. Like, that's how removed we were from all of this. And this joker who I got put next to was kind of trying to punk me. He like knew exactly who I was and what I did, as I found out later in the conversation. But early he said to me, yeah, man, like, do you ball? Like, do you play? What's your player comp? And so I turned to the lady and I said, well, you got to tell him. And she just goes, without hesitation, she goes, oh, he's wet. And that right there is when I fell even more in love than I ever have been. So, John.
Oh, my. I don't even know what to say to that. Yeah, I guess roll the footage. I mean,
you're going to see how wet these shots
can,
were.
Can you stop saying that?
Splashing.
I don't like that either. Okay, the top knot is strong.
The top knot, which apparently I heard afterwards, someone in the crowd was making fun of me, even though splat.
Oh, put that in. All right,
here we are. This one you can't see the
little
mechanics.
Screening action.
You can watch it go in.
Yeah, I mean, you see the bucket. That's the important part.
I haven't hit the rim once.
Oh, stiff screen on the ball, and then he flares. He pops out.
I haven't hit the rim.
Oh, is that you with the hand up in the corner?
I'm in the corner here. You can't even see the head fake. Oh,
but there's a dime. Whips the pass.
There's a dime. Bang. Movement shooting. Haven't touched the rim.
Listen, I can't say the words that you just said without feeling a chill go up my spine. But I will say the jumper looked to be online. Granted, here's what I have to say. I'm watching a highlight reel. Like, every player out there has highlights, right? We got to see the full 48. To know exactly what where the game is. But
I mean, I have the stat sheet over there. I was 4 for 5 from three and champion walking out on top. That's what everyone's playing for this time of year.
So first off, I think it's adorable that you were like, I want to bring this to Dan. I want Dan to see this. And I want
I just wanted you to roast me, honestly.
No, well, I mean, well, first off, like, you look good out there. I got to be honest with you. You know, there's and part of it is, you have enough confidence in your physique that you're not wearing a t-shirt under the reversible. That's one thing. That's a big, you know, like, you're out there playing and you look the part. If you're asking me what I think that game reminds me of.
Yeah.
I will say, while I think about the answer to that, because I made a point. I was like, John, I don't want to see the footage. I want to be able to react to it live. You know, don't do the show before the show. I will say
that at your birthday party, you were telling people you play like Luca.
No. That's not what I said.
Okay, what did you say?
I said, depending on the range of talent on the court, it's a wide range of what I can contribute. Where if we go to like the lowest of the low, I could be Luca out there. When I go to the park and there's a couple kids who didn't even make their high school basketball team, there's a different level of ability. But when I go play pickup with NBA coaching staffs, I'm the worst guy on the floor. There's a different scale.
Okay. You didn't say all of those words at your birthday party. That's fine.
I was intoxicated.
That's
fine. I turned 30 and we were at a brewery. What do you offer me?
I will say, based on what I saw in terms of the confidence at the arc, that stiff ball screen, I was really impressed by that. You laid the wood on that screen. The confidence at running the floor to your lane, knowing where you need to get to, but also the whip pass after the screen and the drive. Can I get away with a fun size Olynyk?
I'll take it.
Is that what, you know, the ponytail obviously is part of it, but like, if we're going just the aesthetic component, I'm like, but it's not like sweeter Lou Amundsen. That's not what we're talking about there.
So what percentage of your answer is being completely swayed by the top knot?
The hair is important. It is an important part of the experience. It's an important part of the aesthetic. Yeah.
To be clear, I usually go full bun, but at that point I had gotten a haircut or it wasn't long enough to go full bun. Right. So I had to do the top knot to keep it out of the face, which is also part of why I need to talk to Jaime Jaca at some point, how that man plays. Same with Josh Giddey, with their hair flying around. And I don't understand it. Shout out to them for being able to do that.
Well, Giddey's hair is like shellacked in place. It seems like it doesn't move though. All that. It's so weird. What kind of hold they've got in their gel. I will say there's the willingness to see the jumper it's not knuckleball, because the willingness to get off of it made me think of Noah. The top knot and the willingness to get off the ball made me think of Joakim Noah. But you're not knuckleballing it with the shot. The shot is the shot's right. So
shot's tight.
I can't sit here and tell you, I would love to make fun of you about this, Jake. I would love to be able to make fun of you about it, but you have the confidence to bring this to us coming off of a championship victory.
Yeah. I saw Chris Haynes talk on TNT about how he won his rec league. So I felt like I could only do my part and talk about how I won my rec league on our show.
I mean, it's wonderful. I think that congratulations are in order. I'll see if as we sort of move through the rest of the broadcast, I guess I'll try to think about if there's another comp
that I like. The
broadcast
is over. This is it. This is the last thing on the rundown.
Maybe like as you're doing the outro, I'll like think of another name.
This is a real time example as to why it takes you so long to file after a game.
Because I'm thoughtful and I'm trying to provide incisive commentary on what I've just watched. John Gennaro, Keith Van Horn is not the right answer.
I will tell you the answer I give at the bottom of the scale.
Yeah, you said Luca.
The answer I give, and I'm happy with, he's truly someone I love watching and I like interacting with. Joe Ingles is my preferred answer. In that clip, I was definitely playing more of a big man type of role, to your point, where it's true. But that was the matchup, and that's part of the Ingles appeal to me. You got to be able to slide down the scale and adapt to what the matchup is showing you.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, if Joe Ingles was playing with a lot of guys who are like 6 foot tall, he might also adopt more of a big man option. I think really the answer here, and what I got to come back to, is something that I brought to Tom Haberstroh when we did this initial game. Jake, you might be Fever Dream Josh McRoberts.
Yes. That's awesome. I'll take it. When I was listening to that, Charlotte McBob was a favorite of mine, for sure. Before the Miami payday, I really thought he was, like, I remember they lost LeBron, they bring in McBob, and I was sitting there being like, whoa, people are going to find out how good this dude is.
Okay, maybe considering that was a comp for
Paolo Banchero and Blake Griffin. Maybe you're just
maybe
fever.
Not fever dream.
Maybe just... you're just fever. Josh McRoberts.
Yeah, feverish Josh McRoberts.
Fevered, cold chills, Josh McRoberts.
In bed with an ice pack on their head, Josh McRoberts. I'll take it. That's honestly a true compliment.
Yeah, mug of hot tea and antibiotics, Josh McRoberts.
I'm going to take that. I'm going to wear it like a sweater. And I'm going to take my ass down to Philly to watch game three tonight.
Hell yeah.
Hopefully you all enjoyed today's show and that little attempt at our cross-platform podcasting here at Ball Don't Lie. That's all we've got for you today. Thanks to super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things he normally does to make the show look and sound great and producing the sizzle reel.
Yeah, even more than usual. It's really, really impressive.
Yeah. Subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you are currently listening on and leave us a 5-star review. That'd be great. Thank you for listening. And we'd appreciate it. Came back again next week for another episode of No Cap.